Welcome again to 2,000 Years of Jewish Odyssey. We'll be looking at the 7th century of the Common Era tonight. Once again, we're sponsored by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ilu Nishmas Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib, Dei Nishmas Rav Tzura B'Tzura Chaim. As the 7th century dawned, the Jewish people were scattered across the settled globe, not really wielding much influence in any one place, and in a sense, just treading water. We had weathered most of the storms of the 6th century, especially the heavy hand of persecution in Bavel, that for a time had abolished the position of the Reish Galusa and sent Torah study underground, and also the brutality of the Christians across the Byzantine Empire that kept Jews alive but subservient, victimized, always targets for religious persecution and ostracism from the general society. The 7th century of the Common Era would change the world in a way that directly impacts on current events. The Jews of Bavel and across the world would encounter a new challenge, a new foe, and a new religion that would reshape history and serve as a counterweight to Christianity, and that, of course, is Islam. Muhammad was born in the year 570 in Mecca. Mecca is a trading town on Arabia's western coast. Mecca then was an important city in the spice trade route to the Orient. What he accomplished makes him a figure of historical importance, even if his followers today grow quite testy about any attempts to describe him or even to humanize him. He's held today by over a billion people in the world to be beyond reproach, beyond criticism, and although human, Muslims are banned from even depicting him in a portrait, a ban that they seek to impose upon the world today, employing for emphasis their, shall we say, explosive temper. In fact, the issue with the Danish cartoons or the Dutch cartoons of the last few years related not so much to the commentary, but to the fact that they purported to have a stick figure, a face, a caricature of what Muhammad looked like, and that to them is beyond the pale. So we assume the risk of talking about him. Who exactly was he? By mainstream accounts, Muhammad was orphaned at a very young age, was illiterate, became a shepherd, and worked for his family for a time as a merchant. He was reputed to be an honest businessman. One of his names by which he's known is Al-Amin. Amin, the trusted one. We'll note again and again the uncanny similarity of Arabic to Hebrew. Amin, of course, from Amen, Al-Amin. He married at 25, a shidduch, to a 40-year-old widow named Khadija. He was also drawn to meditate in the mountains around Mecca, and in his late 30s began to have visions of divine communications, which later led the Rambam to call him simply Hamishuga. Now, Muhammad received his first vision in the year 610, in which, as the legend goes, the angel Gabriel, in Arabic Jibril, designated him as a prophet and directed him to record God's word. Now, there was a political aspect to his visions as well, if not the motivation. Arabia was not a nation as such, but inhabited by a variety of pagan tribes that claimed different territories and had either, some of them at least, a loose affiliation or none at all, and they regularly raided each other, stealing each other's property. Muhammad set out to unite these tribes under one banner. Now, Mecca also had a significant Jewish population at the time. Strange to say, because now a non-Muslim cannot even enter Mecca, much less live there, that's today. Muhammad undoubtedly gained the rudimentary knowledge of the story of the Jewish people and some of our laws from these Jews whom he'd known his entire life. And within that framework, it created the religion of Islam, which means submission or surrender, but of course the root is also salam, being at complete peace and harmony. And he proclaimed himself the final prophet in a chain that included Lahavdil, Adam, Noah, Avram, Moshe, David, and Lahavdil Elef Havdolos, Jesus. Now this was not accidental. The Torah was respected in the world for its morality and its law, even if the Jews weren't. So Muhammad latched on to the story of the Jews. Most of his visions took place during what became the month of Ramadan, but Muhammad's career was very slow to take off. He declared himself the prophet and began preaching publicly in 613, but aside from his wife and a few relatives, always good to have your wife behind you, he had very few followers. When he began to recite the substance of his visions in public, remember he was illiterate, at that time they were recorded by his followers and became known as the Quran, again from the Hebrew word kara, likro, something which is read or something which is recited. The Quran eventually grew to 6,000 verses, broken down into 114 surahs or chapters. Muhammad's words were a hodgepodge of revisionist history, law, mythology, customs, and diatribes against sinners and infidels. In fact, he saw it as one of his main tasks to warn non-believers of the eternal suffering they would receive. Now, Muhammad was a member of the tribe of Quraysh in Mecca, and when they ignored him, he reached out to Mecca's Jews for support, even incorporating some Jewish ideas and practices into early Islam. For example, he ordered Muslims, or his followers, to pray three times a day, and to face Yerushalayim in prayer, and to fast on the 10th day of the first lunar month, akin to Yom Kippurim, and to give charity, and to shun pork, and to circumcise the males, and to observe Shabbos as the day of rest. So you get the picture. Muhammad was a monotheist in a pagan society. So the majority opinion of Chazal is that Islam is a false religion, but it's not Avodah Zarah, it's not idolatrous. And so he had a more natural affinity for the other monotheists in the Arabian Peninsula, to wit, the Jews. His fellow tribesmen of the Quraysh mocked him as he tried to abolish their idols. Unfortunately for him, the Jews, although not very learned or pious, but having been schooled in avoiding the blandishments and the threats of the Christians in Arabia, were not looking for a new religion, and they rejected him as well. To an enormous extent, we pay a price for that rejection until today, obviously a price we had to pay, because Muhammad then turned on the Jews with a vengeance. Among the things they did, the Quran attempted to usurp the identity of Israel. So for example, the Quran claims that Avram had two sons, but had actually chosen Yishmael and not Yitzchak as his successor and heir. He had bound Yishmael on the Akedah, not Yitzchak. That is celebrated until today as a festival, one of the two Muslim festivals, Eid al-Adha, most known to us because in the last 10-12 years they canceled alternate site parking in New York City on that day. But that day, Eid al-Adha, the Feast of the Sacrifice, commemorates the sacrifice of Yishmael. And of course that God had chosen Yishmael to carry his word. Very interestingly, Muhammad refers to the Jews as the people of the book, and almost naturally, in telling the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, takes for granted that Israel is the land of the Jews. It says the Jews are heading to the land that was promised to them. And that's all it really says about the land of Israel. But he also speaks about Jews in the most degrading manner, and Christians as well. So for example, Surah 2, verse 96, Jews are the greediest of mankind. 3:1-12, ignominy shall be their portion wherever they are found. 3:181, taste, you Jews, the punishment of burning. 4:46, Allah has cursed them for their disbelief. Allah, again, is our word Elohim, Aleph Lamed He, the great power.
5:51, believers, take not Jews or Christians for friends. In one hadith, a hadith was the recorded sayings and customs of Muhammad that are the basis, one of the bases for Islamic doctrine and practice. Again, the word is related to das, dat. Muhammad said, the trees and the rocks will say, O Muslim, here is a Jew behind me, come and kill him. And I think probably the most chilling statement, because of the modern implications, is in Surah 4, verse 56, those who disbelieve our revelations, we shall expose them to the fire. As often as their skins are consumed, we shall exchange them for fresh skins, that they may taste the torment. Not a lot of comedy in the Quran, but you understand, since it's common until today for Muslims to memorize the Quran, it's very hard to underestimate the impact, the negative impact that learning such verses as children has on adherence to the faith when they become adults. In truth, Muslims hate all disbelievers as infidels, dividing the world into Dar al-Islam and Dar al-Kharb, Kharb the sword, the world not yet converted to Islam. But they reserve a special contempt for Muhammad's time for the Jews who rejected him. And when he failed to make inroads into the Jewish community, now clearly some did convert, but not a substantial core, but when he failed to bring everyone around, he changed the doctrines to pray 5 times a day, which is a compromise between our 3 and the Christian Catholicism's 7, made Friday, they don't really have a day of rest, but Friday a special day of prayer because Shabbos and Sunday were taken already, facing not Yerushalayim in prayer, but Mecca, abandoning the fast of the 10th, which they still observe in a different form, but now for a month-long fast of Ramadan, etc. There's a profound political dimension to this new religion as well. The Quran records that in 622, Muhammad had a night vision, so to speak, in which the angel Gabriel, Jibril again, cut open his chest, took out his heart, purified it with the waters of the Zamzam well in Mecca, which still exists. They say that's where Yishmael took his water to drink, and then put his now purified heart back in. Once his heart was purified, the mythical steed, Al-Burak, Barak meaning lightning, appeared, carried Muhammad to Masjid Al-Aqsa, to the farthest mosque, which although not explicitly located in the Quran, it's not identified at all, was later identified by Muslims to be Yerushalayim. Although as recently as medieval times, that was not a unanimous opinion. Now that mythical night vision became the source of the Muslims' claim, so to speak, to Yerushalayim. Until today they call the Kotel Al-Burak, named after this white-winged beast that was allegedly tied there while Muhammad prayed. After he prayed, that steed carried Muhammad to the 7 heavens to meet the Allah. I mention this only because the modern impact is enormous and entirely misleading. Yerushalayim was never a holy city to Muslims. It rather contained a holy place that came to them through the vision, this night vision. The Masjid al-Aqsa that was built on the 7th Temple Mount in this very century, the 7th century, to this we will return a little later. Secondly, Muhammad faced intense persecution from his fellow Arabians. And in 622, shortly after the so-called vision, he fled northeastward to Medina, the journey known as the Hijrah, from which date the Muslim calendar is numbered. Now they're finishing the year 1386. Medina was then known as Yathrib, also a prominent city on the spice route, crossroads, inhabited in large part by 3 Jewish tribes, Medina. Muhammad soon entered into a covenant with these tribes, but he abrogated them shortly thereafter. And this began the warlike nature of Islam, which really has not relented. Muhammad's forces regularly raided the wealthy Meccans to sustain themselves. In 624, he expelled one of the tribes, the Jewish tribes from Medina, expelled the second one in 627, and then when this tribe joined with the Quraysh, ostensibly Muhammad's own tribe, to counterattack, they were much more numerous than Muhammad and his followers. Muhammad massacred them in what became known as the Battle of the Trench. For the first time in Arabian warfare, he dug a trench, they weren't anticipating it, and that tripped up the enemy cavalry. Even though you see from the story in Lech Lecha of the War of the Kings, they also succumbed in the trenches near the Dead Sea. Muhammad massacred the third tribe and most of his own tribe, beheaded them, all this in 627, after which Yathrib was renamed Medinat al-Nabi, the province of the Prophet. In 620 he had another vision, after which he ordered his followers to make a Hajj, a pilgrimage back to Mecca. There they encountered resistance from the remaining members of Quraysh and some Jewish tribes there as well. And so Muhammad entered into what was called the Treaty or the Truce of Hudaybiyah, which guaranteed a ceasefire for 10 years and allowed Muslims to make the Hajj. But Muhammad breached this treaty after 2 years, and in 630 he conquered Mecca. Now whether he or he responds to some provocation, so historians dispute. But what's important for us, political activists, and by that I mean right-wingers, will remember and note well the modern implication of this treaty. Muslims were not happy with the terms of this treaty, the Truce of Hudaybiyah, but were urged to honor it by Muhammad, at least temporarily, until the situation would change in their favor, and then they could abrogate it of their own will. I quote now from Professor Mordechai Kedar from Bar Ilan. She says, the Hudaybiyah truce was an agreement which the Prophet Muhammad signed in the year 628 with the infidels of his tribe, the Quraysh. He did so upon their refusal to join the community of Islam when he realized that he could not defeat them militarily. 2 years later, having consolidated his power, he attacked Mecca, slaughtered the men of his own tribe, and torched all the symbols of their heathen culture. Now, Islam considers the actions of the Prophet as religiously sanctioned models for the behavior of the faithful, and this is recorded in the Hadith. Thus, I quote, the Prophet's way of treating his agreement with the Quraysh is perceived as the ideal procedure for Muslims when dealing with non-believers. That is to say, when Muslims cannot impose their will for expanding the rule of Islam by force, they are permitted to sign temporary agreements with the non-believers. Such agreements are to be kept until Allah grants a sufficient increase in Muslim power. At that point, the faithful are allowed or obliged to break the agreements and to impose Islamic terms on the infidels. Why else would Allah have granted them the power to prevail? Atkan, the words of Professor Kedar. So now you'll recall, within days after the signing of the Oslo Accords in 1993, Yasser Arafat referred to the agreements as similar to the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, and he made this comparison numerous times in public until his death. And what he meant was exactly this. Any agreement with Israel is, in his eyes, no more than a Hudaybiyah conciliation accord, to be breached when it suited the Muslim cause. So said Arafat on tape, May 10, 1994, in Johannesburg. This agreement, I am not considering it more than the agreement which had been signed between our Prophet Muhammad and Quraysh. And you remember the Caliph Omar had refused this agreement and considered it a despicable truce. The Treaty of Hudaybiyah was meant to be something temporary that they could then breach when it suited them. Well, it speaks for itself. The problem is, this, until today, has always been studiously ignored by most of the Israeli government, preferring the comforts of the world of luxury to the challenges and discontents of reality. But every Arab and every Muslim knew exactly what Arafat was talking about. With the abrogation of the truce, Muhammad conquered Mecca capture the Kaaba, the large black stone that had been a pagan holy site located, as it were, in the what's called the plain of Arafat. He was named after it. It wasn't named for him. But Muhammad turned it into the center of Islam, designating that rock as the place where Avraham allegedly offered Yishmael on the Akedah. Now it's all within the precincts of the great mosque in Mecca near the aforementioned Zamzam well, from which, as the Quran states, Jibril, the angel, extracted water to give to the thirsty Ishmael. All their events happen there. If nothing else, it reinforces how insignificant the land of Israel is in Islam. Its main function seems to be as the home of the despicable Jews, and therefore ripe for Islamic conquest. Now, Muhammad had succeeded in uniting the tribes of Arabia under the banner of Islam, but when he died, just shortly thereafter, in 632, he's buried in Medina. Right before he gave a farewell address, among other things, he told the Muslims to follow a strictly lunar calendar, not to interpolate the years as the Jews do, and that's why you see the Muslim calendar changes much more dramatically than the Jewish calendar. Ramadan comes out in any point, any season of the year. The wars of Islam were just beginning when he died, and for a simple reason. Until Muhammad's time, the various tribes in Arabia would raid each other when times were bad, because they were pagans, but pagans of different stripes. Now that they were all Muslims, they had only two possibilities: seek out differences in each other worthy of conflict, or attack the foreign infidels. Eventually, they would do both. Now, among other things, Muhammad left behind a succession struggle that is still raging today, almost 14 centuries later. He did not designate a successor. He had no surviving sons. He had only a surviving daughter, Fatima, perhaps another daughter as well, even though he had about a dozen wives. Immediately designated as the leader after his death was his friend and one of his fathers-in-law, strange phrase, one of his fathers-in-law, named Abu Bakr, who became the first caliph, and he ruled also very briefly, just 2 years, succeeded in 634 by the famous Omar. Now his followers became known as the Sunnis. Another branch disagreed immediately and appointed Muhammad's son-in-law, Ali, as the successor. They later became known as the Shia, Shiites, or followers of Ali, and they claim, among other things, that leadership of Islam must come from Muhammad's descendants. And the two have been at war ever since. The Sunnis are much more numerous. The Shia today are a minority, but dominant in Iran, and even a majority of the population in Iraq. Agavurcha, the Wahhabis are a branch of Sunni Islam that is based in Saudi Arabia, and they are mortal enemies of the Shiites, whom they consider to be infidels. In 680, we'll get back to this later, but in 680, the son of Ali, Hussein, was killed by the Sunnis, beheaded in the Battle of Karbala, and he's still mourned by the Shiites every year on the 10th of Muharram. That was the day, a fast day that previously had been parallel to Yom HaKippurim, and the war was on between the Sunna and the Shia. That war really shows no signs of abating at all, but that war is a very ancient war as well. Omar succeeded the father-in-law of Muhammad, Abu Bakr, Umar al-Khattab, the second caliph. He's very important for our history because in the mid-630s he invaded the land of Israel, and in 637 he conquered Yerushalayim after a long siege. He found the Temple Mount covered with rubbish. He cleared the southern portion and he built a wooden mosque there called Al-Aqsa, again the furthest one, from the word Hatzer at the end. He also built what was called the Mosque of Omar opposite the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, confused until today with the Dome of the Rock, which is not. The Mosque of Omar still exists. The story was, well, see, Omar had a tolerance streak. the patriarch of the Church of Yerushalayim refused to surrender except to him. He actually came, accepted the surrender. The patriarch invited him to pray in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and Omar refused, saying, if I pray inside, I must turn into a mosque. Instead, he prayed in the courtyard, and there in the courtyard, he built the Mosque of Omar. He also allowed the Jews to return to Yerushalayim, and 70 families did. The Christians wanted 10 or 12, and he wanted many more, but he compromised, and he allowed the Jews to worship freely as well. And this was significant. Omar made no attempt to convert the Jews to Islam, and in fact, Jews rejoiced somewhat. The persecution of Christians in Israel was something of a payback for their mistreatment of Jews. Christians had banned Jews from living in Yerushalayim about two centuries earlier. So Omar was much more accepting of Jews. He converted pagans, but again, because the Jews have a role in the Quran, he left the Jews alone. He did enforce and institute what became the Islamic tradition of the Dhimmi, which started as follows. There's an Arabian oasis called Khaybar. In fact, there's a similar name of a pass where many battles take place these days in Afghanistan. Khaybar was the first territory attacked and conquered by the Muslim state ruled by Muhammad himself. When the Jews of Khaybar surrendered to Muhammad after a siege, Muhammad allowed them to remain in Khaybar in return for their handing over to the Muslims one half of their annual produce. That was their tax. They were the first Dhimmi. Dhimmi was a second-class status, meaning they're protected by Islamic law as long as they respect their inferiority. Now, at different times in history, depending on the land and the ruler, there were different rules for the Dhimmi. For example, very common, a Jew was never allowed to ride a horse in public. Not that you could ride one in private. But you couldn't ride it in public because by definition you'd be higher than a Muslim. You couldn't walk on the same side of the street as a Muslim. Or if Muslims on the sidewalk and it was raised, you had to go in the road. You couldn't sue a Muslim. You couldn't employ a Muslim servant in your home. You had to pay special taxes. Occasionally you had to wear a yellow badge. We'll return to that. That was a Muslim innovation of the 9th century, not the Christian innovation, as many people think. They borrowed it from the Muslims. This became the basis for what's famously referred to as the Muslim tolerance for Jews, as opposed to the Christian intolerance. And it is relatively true. As long as Jews knew their place, they could live, not freely, but at least without fear of extermination, usually. Now, Omar also conquered Egypt and Syria and North Africa from the Byzantines, and he conquered Persia as well, ending the Sassanid dynasty and bringing Babel under Islamic domination. Within two decades, think about it, within two decades, a little more maybe, most of the world's Jews, a preponderance of the population, came under Islamic rule, under the rule of a religion which didn't even exist 20 years earlier. And that Islamic rule, in less than a century, spread as far as the Caspian Sea, through Asia Minor, North Africa, all the way up to the Atlantic, and conquering all of Iberia as well. But for the Battle of Tours, Poitiers, in 732 in southern France, in which the king of the Franks, Charles Martellus, named the Hammer, presumably after Judah Maccabee, the Hammer, if not for the fact that he stopped the Muslim advance in southern France and defeated their forces and saved Christianity for Europe, the entire world would have come under Muslim domination. Now, this was even more critical than it sounds, because in 613, for the first but not the last time, Jews were forcibly expelled from Spain several years after the very practice of Judaism was banned outright in Spain. Of course, the identical scenario would repeat itself 8 centuries later. Jews fled northward then to France, but there in 629, Dagobert I, who was the king of the Franks, most known, he was one who made Paris his capital, forced Jews to convert and expelled those who refused to convert. At the same time, some Jews fled to North Africa, but many stayed, both in Spain originally and then in France, either converting or pretending to convert. But in fact, Islam became a counterforce. Additionally, in the death throes of those two powerful empires, Byzantium and Persia, they fought a series of wars in the early part of the 7th century in the land of Israel. So the Byzantines were in control. In 610, the Persians wrested Israel from the Christians with the help of the Jews. By 628, Byzantium had won it back, only to have the Muslims conquer them as well, in 638. It would be about 5 centuries before the Christians would return to Israel, and even then for less than a century. If you think about it, again, we see the Yad Hashem that allows non-Jewish rivalries in the world that paradoxically protect us by giving the nations something else to fight about, meaning each other, and places of refuge when one locale becomes too dangerous. So by 637, all of Babel was under Muslim rule of the Umayyad dynasty of Sunnis under the rulership of Omar. Rav Shri Ragon writes in his Igeres that Rav Chinenai was the Gaon in Farush Shapur at the time, Uvi Amav Yatsam Muhammad La'alam. And during his time as the Gaon, Muhammad came upon the world. When Omar conquered Babel, he befriended the Jews and appointed a new Reish Galusa, with whom he had very positive relations. Reish Galusa himself had a remarkable pedigree known to us as Bustanai, and it's quite a story or a legend. So the legend dates from a few centuries after his lifetime, but nonetheless, it's a legend that's come down to us in a variety of sources, some of them conflicting. During the final years of Persian rule, the king Horasos II turned on the Jews with a vengeance, imprisoned Jews by the thousands, and made a concerted effort to exterminate Beis David, meaning the house of the Reish Galusa. Reish Galusa was a direct descendant of David HaMelech. He killed everyone, including the Reish Galusa, Rav Haninai, whose young wife was pregnant at the time and went into hiding. One night, Horasos II had a dream. He was in his orchard. He dreamt, chopping down fruit trees, all the fruit trees, and before he could cut down the last fruit tree, an old man with a reddish complexion and a majestic appearance appeared to him, took an axe, and whacked him in the forehead until his whole face was covered with blood. The king awoke. That was the dream. And this week we read Parshas Miketz. Very clear similarities to Parshas Miketz. None of his advisors could explain the meaning of the dream. They told him, there's so many Jews, so many rabbis in prison. Let's get one. They took an old Jew from prison. As the story goes, unlike Yosef, he refused to bathe or shave. So the king could see how he's treating the Jews and saying to the king, Le'elokim tisranim, the solutions are God's. Tell me your dream. He heard the dream and he said to the king, the old man was David HaMelech, and the orchard is Beis David. It's the royal house of David, and you have killed almost every descendant. Only one tree remains, that last tree. And the king was chastened, to say the least, and he asked what could he do to make amends, and the old man said that he's the father of the woman who's in hiding. And she was spared. She gave birth to a child whom she named Bustanai, Bustan, meaning in Persian and now in Hebrew as well, an orchard. He grew up and he was appointed the Reish Galusa. Not only that, but for the next 3 centuries, all the Reish Galusa were all descendants of Bustanai. Now this itself became a problem. We'll get back to the veracity of the story in a moment, but The true problem was when Horasos II was conquered just a few years later by Omar, Bustanai made such an impression on Omar, he had a very regal appearance as well, that Omar confirmed him as the Reish Galusa. Omar took one daughter of Horasos for himself as a wife and gave the second daughter to Bustanai, that she should be his wife as well, notwithstanding that she wasn't Jewish, he couldn't refuse. She converted, Kalocha, and was known to the Jews as Bustanai's Persian wife, because he had a Jewish wife too. And there was persistent, there would be persistent conflict between the offspring of his two wives as to the office of the Resh Galusa. Now, it seems that the legend was created to boost Benai's standing, or that of his descendants, and to defer the claims of Resh Galusa in other parts of the world, such as they existed in Egypt or Turkey, who then would not be considered descendants of David, because he's basically saying he was the last descendant of David HaMelech alive. So it's only his chain who are Malchus Beis David and no one else. Now this in fact was not true. Rav Sharagon himself writes that he is a descendant of Bein Nisio, v'lo Bustanai anachno, but we're not descendants of Bustanai, implying that at least that element of the story is not true. Rav Sharagon actually did write that he said that his family abandoned the evil ways of the Resh Galusa, v'ayli b'rabbonah b'mesifta, and we joined the rabbis in the yeshiva, l'mivah anova v'shiflus v'mimichus, seeking modesty, humility, meekness. We just wanted to teach Torah and not get involved in politics. What's also true is that Bustanai was given a wife by Omar, one of the daughters of Chorasos II. In any event, Bustanai, they're different and conflicting accounts of the legend, but in fact Bustanai did exist, and he was invested with enormous temporal power, again, like in days of yore, the power to appoint Jewish judges, the power to levy taxes, and Jews once again regained considerable autonomy in Bavel. Why did the Muslims restore this right? Interestingly, they were more focused on conquest than on governance. The early Muslims were basically nomadic tribes, and they had no tradition at all of administration, of bureaucracy, of political leadership. So across the world, wherever they conquered, they regularly deferred to the local population that was subservient, that would pay tribute, their main concern being taxes. And so they let the Jews in Bavel rule themselves, they let the non-Jews rule themselves as well under the supervision of a Muslim. Whereas in the 6th century, authority had shifted away from the Resh Galusa to the Gaonim and the Rosh Yeshiva. Now the two groups would frequently be at loggerheads, although not during the reign of Bustanai, of whom the Gaonim spoke very highly for the respect he showed them and for his non-interference and even overt support for the study of Torah in the Babylonian yeshivas. So the tide had turned so much in less than a century that the yeshiva in Firush Shapur, you remember, that had been a refuge. When the main yeshivas had to close in the 6th century, that yeshiva was now closed itself and relocated back to Pumbedita, which was a larger city. This occurred after an incident that Rav Sharagon also records. After Ali and Muhammad's son-in-law assumed authority in Bavel, Rav Yitzchak Gaon and 90,000 Jews of Firush Shapur greeted him, and vice versa, the savior upon him, Yafos, and Ali, Muhammad's son-in-law, became a friend of the Jews. It didn't help him at all. In 661, Ali was assassinated after a feud with the governor of Syria, Muawiyah, who was a relative of the caliph Othman, who had succeeded Omar, and none of these guys ever died of natural causes. Muawiyah established the Umayyad dynasty, which lasted until 750. The Umayyads were very cultured, very sophisticated. They introduced into their domain, which is a sizable swath of territory, unified coinage. They improved and secured roads, and so trade developed immensely, stretching from the Far East all the way to Spain, that is to say, across the civilized world. Next time, we'll discuss the indispensable role that Jews played in the development of international trade. But it was Muawiyah's son, Yazid I, who murdered Ali's son, Hussein, and his whole family, the final rift between the Sunnis and Shiites that took place in 680. You'll recall, by the way, if you've seen clips of the 80s and 90s, even today, you find sometimes there are days in Iran where the faithful take whips and beat themselves. Days of self-flagellation. One of those days is this, the 10th of Muharram, when they're mourning the assassination of Hussein and his family. So that's a big Shia holiday. So the Muslim world then was a divided schism that lasts until today. But nor was it completely harmonious in the Jewish world. When Bustanite died, you thought it was. No. When Bustanite died in 670, he was succeeded as Reish Galusa by his son Chizdai, his son through his so-called natural Jewish wife. But Chizdai tried to discredit, so as to remove from the scene, all his half-brothers by claiming that his father's other wife, the daughter of Harasos II, was not Jewish and had never converted to Halacha. This question came before the Gaonim, the Chaninai Sura, and he paskin that no, she was fully Jewish, and they're all Jews. From then on, there was hostility between the descendants of Chizdai, that chain of Bustanai, and the Gaonim, with Chizdai's successor, his son Shlomo, even deigning to appoint the Gaon of Pumbedisa on his own, which did not earn either the respect of the Gaon in Sura. One other architectural note, the Dome of Barak, Kippat HaSela in Hebrew, was built around the Eben Shesia on the Temple Mount in the year 691, making it the oldest continuously extant building in the Islamic world, although it's undergone many changes over the years. It was built under the supervision of another Umayyad caliph, Abd al-Malik, and it was intended as a shrine. It's not a mosque. It's a shrine. He meant it as a place where people would just be protected from the heat or cold when they were going to visit Al-Aqsa. But as I noted earlier, it's long been confused with the Mosque of Omar. There's one other very fascinating historic occurrence in the 7th century that also shapes Jewish life until today, and that is the beginning of Shilas and Shuvos from across the world. That started in the 7th century. The oldest we have on record, I grant that the Gemara will say sometimes, Shoftim Kom, they ask questions from Bagel to Eretz Yisrael, vice versa. But from coming elsewhere in the world to a central rabbinic authority, that really started in the 7th century. So the Gaon of Sura, Rav Sheshna, he became the Gaon there in 660, he was the first whose Shuvos were actually recorded, and we have some of them, answering questions from across the Jewish world. Just think of the amount of time it took to ask a question and get an answer. And the question is really similar to the questions we have today. Some, you know, it sounds simple. But when Jews are distant from the wellspring of Torah, questions arise. For example, what was a compendium of these tshuvos called Shari Tshuva. So Kuf Nun Hey, one question is, do we wear tefillin on Tisha B'Av? That was a question that was asked. And Rav Sheshna Gaon answered, yes, the question is about Avelus, because an Avel on the first day doesn't wear tefillin, perhaps the same thing. But Rav Sheshna said, no, the practice of the two yeshivos, of Pumbedisa and Sura, is to wear tefillin on Tisha B'Av. So of course we do that as well. We just do it in the afternoon. Questions about distribution of marital property and really all the issues that we would discuss today just came up, but it was the first time it was actually recorded and then disseminated. So it became a tool for teaching Torah as well. So this was a new world for Jews and new opportunities. The interaction between communities that would revolutionize trade and commerce would also forever link Jews and Torah and ensure that despite local differences and minor details or customs, Jews could feel at home eating and davening and learning with other Jews no matter where they were in the world. So just to summarize, in a sense, the Jews had a remarkable and unexpected renaissance in the 7th century of the Common Era. Think about where we were when it started, and even the early years, the first two or three decades. The Jews of Spain were expelled, France were expelled, but the Christian world that had so persecuted the Jews met its match, at least then, in the rise of Islam. Islam, like Christianity, patterned itself after Judaism, but did not attract any sizable contingent of Jewish adherents, which offended Muhammad and led to diatribes and worse against the Jews. his early interactions with the Jews of Arabia did not end well for those Jews, and the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, breached by Muhammad, became a paradigm for Islamic diplomacy with infidels that's practiced until today. But Islam, in the early years, was content with military conquest and confiscation of wealth, and not so much with imposing their religious beliefs on others. So they were very often benevolent conquerors to Jews, as dhimmi, as official second-class citizens. The Caliph Omar conquered Eretz Yisrael in 638, built the Mosque of Al-Aqsa on the Temple Mount. That's not the same one that exists today, because that was later destroyed, rebuilt to the same place. And of course, later on, the Dome of the Rock was built too. Except for a brief period, lasting less than a century, through most of the 12th century, Muslims of various nations from 638 would control the land of Israel until the year 1917, when the British conquered it. So with the Arab conquest of Persia and Mesopotamia, the Jews of Babel fell under Muslim domination, but Omar began the process of restoring the Rosh Galusa to its prior glory, and the rule of Bustanai began centuries of hereditary governance in tandem with, not always innocuously, the Gaonim. The two yeshivas of Pumbedisa and Sura flourished again as the century came to a close. The Gaonim began to respond to halachic questions from across the world. The 8th century would see Jews interact throughout the world while trying to keep the peace at home with each other and avoid entanglement in the wars of the Muslims and the Christians. Thank you very much. We resume again in 2 weeks.